Welcome to another episode of the Audaciousness Podcast with me, Helen Strong.
And me, Maribel Ortega. In this podcast, we showcase individuals who have set themselves bold and audacious goals and have worked to achieve them with the aim of inspiring others to also set themselves audacious goals and to create a positive movement in the world.
We'd like to highlight the fact that even regular people like you and me can have audacious goals and that role models are in fact all around us. Each and every one of us can have an impact in some way.
Thank you for listening. We are delighted to have you with us. So Helen, tell us about the guests we're going to hear from today.
We're going to hear from a lady called Rika Kossi. And Rika grew up in Germany, lived in New Zealand and Australia for a few years, and then decided with her husband to give up the suburban lifestyle and move to a rural location in Sweden, where she and her husband and two young kids are now trying to live from the land and growing and raising their own food. And Rika's story is actually quite similar to my own, except for the kids. So I was really interested to hear what she's doing and what challenges she's facing in becoming self-sufficient in both her food and energy production. And the reason we found out about Rika is because she'd been following our podcast episodes for some time. And as you know, at the end of every podcast, we say to our listeners that if they themselves have done something audacious, then please get in touch as we'd love to hear from you. Mm. And that's exactly what Rika did. So if anyone else would like to be interviewed for our podcast, please get in touch. Our contact details are at the bottom of our webpage at audaciousness.captivate.fm. But in the meantime, let's hear from Rika.
Okay, we'll listen to the interview with Rika now and then come back in half an hour to talk about what we learned. We hope you enjoy the interview.
Rika, hello, and thank you for agreeing to share your audacious story with us. Now, you're one of the first people on this podcast who's actually come forward and volunteered to be interviewed yourself, which is great because we found that many people, when we ask them about the audacious things that they do, they tend to say, well, it wasn't really audacious. It was just something I did. So I do applaud your audacity in coming forward and saying, yes, I think what I did was audacious and my story is worth hearing. I think we need more people with that kind of confidence to come forward in the world.
Definitely.
So I wonder if we could begin with you telling us briefly, what are some of the audacious things that you've done or are still doing in your life?
That I would have to go really far back, but I might not start at the very beginning, but I've moved a lot. So I grew up in Germany. And I left roughly when I was 16 to go to New Zealand as an exchange student, which at the time was already, I could come from a really small town. And at the time, no one had really left. And I was one of the first ones to ever do an exchange here in school, which people thought was crazy. And now it's not so crazy anymore. But back then, it seemed really crazy. And that kind of continued. That kind of got me hooked onto moving around the world. So I lived in New Zealand and Australia. My husband's actually from New Zealand, and we traveled together. We've been to Brazil. We lived in Hungary for a while. I lived in Slovakia for a while, and now we're in Sweden, and we're trying to find what we really want and what we need to do ourselves. And yeah, I think it kind of started really early for me. And what I do today is that my husband and I, we own a small farm here in Sweden. And on that farm, we have a tiny house on wheels where we used to live in for 2 years before we bought our farm. And now we're turning it into a guest house, which is very scary. And we're trying our luck with farming. So we got chickens when we moved to Sweden, and now we're getting ready to get turkeys and sheep. And neither of us has really got much experience with animals. And so this is quite a big step. And although I grew up in a small town, I was never really exposed to a lot of animals. We only really had cats at home, and I have cats again. But having bigger animals and more responsibility like that for living creatures is something that I find challenging, but I also enjoy doing. And I think that's one of the things that has always really helped me, that I just do it. And it's quite interesting when you say that I'm the first one to come forward, because I know that what I do is not everyone's cup of tea, but for me, I wouldn't want to have it any other way.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things that we can pick up on there. What I'd like to pick up on is what took you abroad in the first place? You said you came from a small town where nobody traveled, and you were one of the ones to do that. So what was going through your mind back then? Was there some kind of calling in you saying that you had to travel, or what was it?
I think if you're spiritually inclined, you would say it was a calling. I just wanted to get away at the time. Like, I wanted to get away as far away as possible. And New Zealand happened to be on the other side of the world. And that's where I wanted to go. So I was always pushing further and pushing boundaries of where I was.
What did you discover about yourself or about traveling or about the world in those initial years where you were traveling?
I think so. The first time in New Zealand was really easy. I had great contacts there. I was welcomed into families that were really open, and that was really easy for me. I think my years after that, especially when I was in Slovakia, I just learned that there are things that I cannot change, and I need to be patient with myself and everyone around me. And there are unfortunately also situations that aren't always pleasant, and that's okay too. But mind you, I'm saying this today after all the, like, it's been 15 years that I left Slovakia, and that was the hardest year of my life. And I'm now happy to talk about it, but at the time it was really tough. So yeah, I think what I learned is to be more open and to be more accepting of what's coming in, and to not try and control every situation.
Do you want to say a little bit more about what happened in Slovakia? I'm curious now.
So in Slovakia, I was in the east of Slovakia. There's two towns, Košice and Prešov, for those who listen and who might know a little bit more about Slovakia. And I was between those two towns in a small town so there were 600 people there, 400 Roma and 200 Slovaks. I didn't really speak Slovak at the time, or now for that matter. And I was tasked to live in a school for disabled children. And those children were severely disabled. Some of them were blind and deaf. And I had to work and live with them. And I had no background in how to take care of these kind of disabled children. I had trouble communicating with the staff, and I was all on my own. And that combination was extremely tough, because if you can't communicate what's going on, if you're not understood language-wise, but also emotionally where you're at, and then you're tasked to take care of children in that case that really rely on you and that really need you, it was very strenuous. And I was a volunteer year, and I left for Christmas. I went home for Christmas, and I almost didn't come back. So I was in the school in the end, probably 7 months. And at the end, I had managed to escape and create a little pod outside of the school where I was able to escape to on the weekend. But during the weeks, I was at the school, and that was really tough. That was just really tough.
Thanks for sharing that story, Rika. I wonder, through that experience, You mentioned that 15 years ago you were very impatient, and that there are things that you can't change. And obviously, I have the impression that you have learned that. How did you learn to accept those things that you can't change and let go?
I still wouldn't call myself a very patient person, but I'm trying to. I think So when you travel and when you interact with other people, and especially if you're having to interact in a language that's not your own, that you kind of have to be impatient. There is no real other way. And I don't think I can answer that question any other way than you have to experience it and you have to go through it. And you have to accept that you cannot control everything. And if you want to, in my case, I can only say Slovakia was probably very difficult for me because I had high standards and high expectations. I wanted it to be perfect. I wanted it to be a great time. I wanted to be close to the locals. I wanted to experience the local culture. I was really interested in how Roma lived. I really wanted to engage, but I just couldn't. And having this blockage, whether it was self-made or whether it was forced up on me, I think just accepting that blockage is part of the journey. And yeah, it's self-acceptance, I think, that I learned.
I read somewhere that having high expectations is kind of like the first step to being disappointed.
Mm.
Can you say something about that? Is that something that you have experienced?
It's something that I travel between, to be entirely honest. Like, I sometimes think, yes, absolutely, if you have high expectations, then you're bound for failure because you can never live up to your expectations that you create. But at the same time, I also think if you have no expectations, then you will never be positively surprised and you'll never exceed your expectations and you never reach your next goal. So I'm in between the two. I am someone who likes to put up a lot of expectations for myself, but I've also learned that I have to be okay with if it doesn't work. And I have to be relaxed enough to say, okay, this didn't work. I need to try something else, or I need to take a step back and evaluate why it didn't work. But I don't think having no expectations is the right way either. So it's a balance between the two.
Nicely put. Yeah.
So you
said then you moved to Sweden and are trying your hand at farming. What are your expectations of that?
They have already failed, to be entirely honest. I was like, speaking of expectations, I wanted to earlier this year, so we're in July now. And in March and April, I set up a garden. I fenced it and we have a lot of deer. So I set up the fence. So I was like, okay, it's all prepared. The soil is there. The fence is there. My garden will flourish. And I started putting seeds in the ground and I set everything up. And then the weeds just took over. And the soil is rubbish. The weeds just took over. And it's just, there's a handful of peas that have grown. That's it. So I'm learning. And that's like, I think that's the balance that, again, that I have to find. I had no prior knowledge of being able to mitigate that properly. And now I'm learning that I need to, for example, control the weeds. And I know, so we moved to this property last year and we're really very consciously taking our time with getting to know everything and not rushing to conclusions. And for example, moving into our house that we have here, we're very slow with remodeling it because we wanted to get to know the house before we started working on it and not just move in and say, this needs fixing and this needs fixing and we're going to do this, but to experience what it's like to live on the property, to see where the light comes from and what the rain does to your house and all sorts of things. So it's tough. It's really tough to come in and to think you're going to have a great life and then to go, I might not. I might have to wait. I might have to wait a year or two before I can even begin to get to where I would like to be.
Mm-hmm. Good. And what brought you to Sweden and to this particular place and to the idea that you wanted to start farming in the first place?
All coincidences.
Coincidences. Do you believe in those?
Sorry?
Do you believe in coincidences?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. So I often get the question why we moved to Sweden, and I sometimes jokingly answer because I'm a big fan of Ace of Base. But for those who grew up in the 90s,
I remember Ace of Base.
But it was honestly, so we lived in Australia before and we lived a very suburban life. When my husband worked, he traveled into Sydney every day. I was home with two small kids and we were just tired. It wasn't working for us. So we decided we need to come back to Europe. We wanted to come back to Europe and I didn't want to go to Germany. So we just basically flipped a coin and had a look around. And we came to Sweden and we wanted to have a tiny house. And we got a builder here. We found a builder who could build our tiny house to what we wanted. And then we lived in the tiny house on rented property for 2 years. And then basically in those 2 years, we were looking and property hunting and then found our property last year and moved.
How was the experience? I'm really curious about that, of living in a tiny house. Can you explain to us a little bit how tiny a tiny house is for four people, I think?
So we're four. Uh-huh. Our tiny house is 10 meters long and 3 meters wide, but it has two levels. It sounds massive, but so we have a loft level where you can't stand up. It has floor space of 39 square meters. And it always shocks people a little bit, but we lived with two kids and working from home in a tiny house on wheels, which is quite extreme, but I absolutely loved it. I loved the fact that the house was designed for exactly what we needed. So we had a dedicated working space. We had a dedicated storage space. We had dedicated play area for the kids. So it was all the way we needed. And we moved in and it was immediately ours. And I think that made it so easy for us. It was just what we needed in that moment. And my kids have now unfortunately literally outgrown the tiny house. My son complained that he couldn't play in their room anymore because it was just not big enough. So it was absolutely right for us at the time. And I was actually, we were just at the beginning, we talked about the fact that we have a thunderstorm here at the moment. And that's one thing that I really miss in the tiny house, where you're much closer to the outside world. So our bedroom, I don't know how thick the ceiling was exactly, but it always felt like when there was rain outside, it was just drizzling on your head. And that's just fabulous. You can lie there, you can hear the rain, you can really feel the wind, and you're nice and dry. And I don't have the same in our house now.
So you seem to be very close to nature, and now you have a farm. What does it give you?
It's a good question. I don't know. I think I enjoy city life. It's nice, but I get overwhelmed by people and I get stressed if there is too much going on. And I can sense for example, when I travel and I'm just going with the flow, I get really stressed out once I realize that that's happening. And if I'm just pushed along, I always like putting on a handbrake and saying, no, I do not want this, or I need to do it differently. And farm life and out in the country, that gives me that ability to come back to who I am.
It's the thunderstorm.
But it's honestly, I can't really answer the question straight up what made me want to go back to nature and why I would have done that. It wasn't a conscious decision, I don't think.
Can I ask how old your children are?
6 and 8.
And can you say something about the challenges of living in a tiny house or bringing them over to Sweden from Australia or moving into the farm or any of the challenges that you've faced with a young family?
To be entirely honest, my family, so my immediate family, so my kids and my husband, they were never the problem, was always the outside. So my extended family back in Germany. My kids, they're extremely adaptable. We're very close as a family. So my kids have never really questioned what we're doing or struggled against it. They sometimes ask me, my daughter asked me the other day when we're moving again. So I think they kind of, it's inbuilt that we're always on the move, which made me a little bit sad at the time, but I think they're just so used to adapting and not being pushed around, but being in new environments. So it seems to be very normal for them. My extended family was tougher because they didn't understand what we were trying to do. They didn't understand why we would want to live in a tiny house. My mom at one point asked me why we don't have a real house, that she felt sorry for us that we didn't have a real house. And just questions like that really, that those were difficult to answer and to face, because I love my extended family, but having to explain my decisions without the acceptance first was difficult to do, is still difficult to do.
And how do you do it?
With patience and sometimes just with facts. So I'm quite looking forward to, my mom's going to come in a week's time and stay in the tiny house as a guest. So I'm forcing her to accept what it means to live in a tiny house.
That's a good way of dealing with it then. That's the question. How can you do that? Well, you're going to do it.
Yeah, it's difficult. You might know this, that in Germany, there is still this the stereotype of a farmer who lives on the land and who is a little bit stupid and just like farms and has animals. And it's got like this stereotype of, why would you do that? Why would you grow your own animals, slaughter your own chickens and all these things when you can just get it from the supermarket? And just this, yeah, so this attitude towards farmers is not a good one. And that's what my family put on us as well. And when I'm being called a farmer's wife, then I don't really like that, because of this ingrained German stereotype that comes up in me. But I have to remind myself that it's okay. It's what we have to do. And I don't know how much time you guys have, there is a huge purpose behind why we're doing what we're doing, which is that both my husband and I are very concerned about the state of our planet. And we want to prepare ourselves and our kids for what's coming. And we want to go back to how things were done even just 100 years ago. So raising our own meat, growing our own vegetables with all its challenges, is that's essential to our mission in life, and to prepare our children to be able to do that. And our children, they have seen us killing chickens, and they haven't gutted them themselves, but yeah, they're watched.
So you're saying, Rica, that you're preparing your family for what's coming. Mm-hmm. What's coming?
I mean, we're recording this just as Germany experienced massive floods last week. And I think we're in a state now where we don't know what's coming. We don't know if societies are going to collapse. We don't know if the weather is going to play tricks on us, if I may say it like that. I don't like speaking of the doom of the world, but I also want to be prepared for any emergency. So if there is a power outage, for example, I want to be prepared and have a generator on hand. If there is a collapse, like it sort of happened in the pandemic last year, that supermarkets don't get enough supplies anymore. Mm-hmm. I want to be prepared for that. I want to be able to feed myself, even if I can't go to a store. And especially in a country like Sweden, where there's a lot of reliance on electronics and electronic paying systems, for example, I also begin to question that and wonder what happens if there is no power anymore. If you build your system on sandy ground, then what happens if the sand gives way? So it's a, like I said, if you have a lot of time, we can get into that. But for me, when I look at the state of the world today and at all the prognoses for the next 10 years, for the next 50 years, which is my kids' life expectancy, then I get really worried, and I try to counter that with activism in the way that I try to prepare them for being self-sufficient, and to not have to rely on a system that might or might not still be here.
So if anybody listening to this podcast, Rica, is interested in doing the same type of thing, has the same type of concerns, what advice would you give to them?
Explore your options. Explore what you can do. I often get this question that not everyone can run a farm, and I totally understand that. But what everyone can do is explore their options. So what can you minimize in your consumption, for example? Can you minimize the way you shop, the way you go to the supermarket, the way you shop for everything else in life, the way you spend your money? Can you minimize the way your dependency on traveling? Can you rethink usage of your car, because if there is the price of petrol goes up, then you will not be able to use your car anymore. And then can you rethink the way you travel? So there's a lot of things that we can take into our own hands. While climate change is not something that we can solve on an individual level, we can each prepare ourselves for taking charge of our lives again and not being so dependent on bigger systems. And I mean, simple examples is you can learn to cook. If you are able to prepare your own food, then you're independent of processed foods from the supermarket. Things like that. Learn about food preservation. If that's one of my things, is that when I have a garden going, once it's set up, I need to establish a good routine to store my vegetables and not let them go bad or have them taken over by rats or whatever. One thing that I really look for here as well as the local community. So we know, for example, we have a dairy farm down the road, and we're getting to know them now. And they're a Dutch family that's moved here last year. So we have something in common. And but just getting to know our neighbors. So we have the dairy farm, and then we also have on the other side of the town, we have cows, and they also get pork delivered from another farm. So we're kind of building up our network of where we can get stuff if mm-hmm. the supermarket closes or if the mm-hmm. chains fall flat. And there's a really cool system in Sweden, in many Swedish cities, where local farmers organize themselves on a Facebook group and then just post what they want to sell that particular week. And then you order it through Facebook and then you pick it up. And it's really nice, and it's all locally produced and directly from the farm. So you can talk to them and say what you want or what you didn't like or whatever. So having this local network is actually mm-hmm. quite easy in Sweden. I didn't expect it this way. Mm. But there's a lot of local networks of producers who just get together and encourage each other, learn from each other, teach each other, and buy and sell from each other. So we're really setting up our local roots here to also counter that, because we can't have everything on our farm.
Yeah, that is really important. And I do think going back to local production is going to be crucial in the future as well. Yeah,
and like I said, like the easiest thing you can do to be independent is to cook for yourself and have your own source of food. Mm-hmm. So
definitely.
It always strikes me when I see how many people rely on supermarket foods and how many children think that milk grows in a carton. Yeah.
Yeah. Your kids must be learning so much. They must be having a fantastic life.
They don't know any different.
Yeah.
That's just what they know. And like they're so used to everything, like we have bees, you get the honey out. That's what you do. That's where the honey comes from. They don't understand that others don't understand. Mm. And it's sometimes really funny. Even here in our like rural town, not many people do this, especially with kids. And I think my kids sometimes struggle to understand that others don't have that this way.
Yeah. How can you see the future panning out for both yourself and your husband and for your children?
That changes on a daily level, on an hourly level. I would like my future to be one where I can do things on my own. I'm able to do it, and I can choose not to do it. So having the choice to go back to a system or to do it myself. I think that's the future I would love to see for myself and for my family, to be able to voluntarily participate in something that I don't have control over and not be forced to do it.
A question is coming up for me about values. Can I ask you about your values, Rika?
Yeah, my biggest value is honesty and authenticity.
What does that mean for you?
There is a meme that I saw the other day on Facebook, which really made me laugh. There is a T-shirt that said, I'm German, so I say what everyone else thinks. And that's kind of encapsulates it for me. I try to, I, I sometimes can't hold back my opinions. And sometimes I do fall on my face with them, but it seems like a long time ago now, but about a few years ago, I worked in an office job. And although I really supported the organization, the job I was doing was just not for me. And the organization culture was just not for me. And I really felt out of place. And looking back on it now, I know that I wasn't living and working in an authentic way to me. So I was just doing a job. And because it didn't fit, I left unconsciously at the time. And now I know why I left, but I really struggled. Yeah, so authenticity and honesty is my two biggest values.
And do you feel you're living those now in the situation where you are?
I think so, yeah. More than I would, for example, in a city life.
I admire that quest to continue looking, and well, in your case, it's with traveling to find that authenticity in your life. And also what you mentioned, that not everyone is applauding what you're doing. On the other hand, criticizing, and still you do what you want. How does that feel?
It's sometimes quite confronting, and sometimes it's really scary, but I want to just push through it. So I mentioned the tiny house being a guest house. We had our first guest last week, and the day before we hooked up our grey water system, and everything was very last minute. And I said, you know, I'm not going to cancel this reservation. We're going to pull through, and we just have to do it. We just have to do it. Like sometimes I find that more satisfying than delaying and putting it off. And
yeah, you learn from it. You get your feedback, yeah. And then you learn from it. Exactly.
80% is good enough.
Rika, we're coming towards the end of our talk. It's been fascinating. I've really enjoyed what you've talked about, and it's very close to my own heart, because that lifestyle is kind of what I'm heading for, where I am as well. I'm going to ask you one final question, and this is to do with the name of our podcast, which is Audaciousness. And the audacious part is about having the audacity to do this thing that you do in the first place. The word ness is an archaic word which is used to describe a spit of land which juts out into the sea and remains standing no matter what the elements are throwing at it. So the question, our final question to you is, what is it that keeps you standing, gives you the solid ground to keep on going and keep pursuing these goals that you've been pursuing despite everything that life has thrown at you?
I knew this question was going to come. So I'm all prepared. I think my nest is my curiosity. I don't know where it comes from really, but it's just this need to keep trying new things and to not stop, and to explore what else can be done, and to keep looking and learning, and to keep trying.
Lovely.
Very nice.
Thank you very much, Rika, for speaking to us. This has been a lovely interview. I've enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So that was a very interesting conversation with Rika there. And listening to that again, Helen, would you say that was serendipity, Rika contacting us and there being like so many things that are relatable between how you live and how she lives with her family?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I said earlier that we have so much in common, because I grew up in England, and then I moved to Germany, where I lived for 20 years. And then I moved to the Outer Hebrides, where I decided that I wanted to become self-sufficient in my food and production. And so a lot of what she was saying resonated with me completely. I thought it was great that she lived in the tiny house beforehand. We didn't do that. We just moved, although I was traveling in my camper van for quite some time before that. So I guess that was a similar thing. What resonated with me, I think probably the most, was not actually what she was doing, but the reasons why she's doing it. So she talked a lot. I mean, she talked about climate change, but I think for me, the main thing for me wanting to be self-sufficient in my own food and energy production is because of what Rika was saying with the uncertainty of what's going to happen in societies moving forward and the reliance on global supply chains, you know, and supermarkets running out of food like we saw during the beginning of the pandemic last year. And also she mentioned, you know, electronic currency and payment methods. You know, we just don't know what is going to happen in the future. And one thing that she did realize was that you can't do this on your own. You know, no matter how big your farm is, really you need the community to help you. So she mentioned that somebody down the road has got the dairy farm and they can get, you know, pig meat and so on. And this is one thing which I also think is very important. I'm having a little bit of difficulty where I am right now securing this, but I think you have to have a network around you. And I said this in the interview as well, that I do believe that going back to local production is the way that we're going, because we need to be thinking about where we're going to get our food from in the future if these big systems are failing. And to me, I can see that they're failing. You know, that you, mm-hmm. if you want to be autonomous, you want to be able to make your own choice. So Rika talked about being able to make your own choice about what to do. And in order to be able to do that, you have to secure your own food and energy supplies. So these, you know, some big things, and you know, not just on how to do it, although she did give some excellent advice on how to do it, but her reasons just resonated with me completely. What about you?
Well, certainly what she said about globalization and the industrialization of food production, when she was talking about her seeds going away or going bad or whatever, or securing, making the food that she was able to harvest to last longer. When she mentioned that, I was thinking, well, I have no idea how to do that. And the fact that everything that we get in a supermarket is, at least let's say 90% of what you can get there is somehow packed. So maybe in the vegetable section, you can have things that are, you know, that you can get loose items. This high industrialization of food has moved us away from understanding how they grow and what we can do with them.
Definitely. And so, you know, she said learn to cook is a thing. Mm-hmm. And in order to learn to cook, I think you need to learn to appreciate the vegetable itself, you know, the food item itself. You need to know what to be able to do with it and how to be able to create a balanced diet with what you're doing as well, instead mm-hmm. of just getting something which has been pre-packaged in a supermarket. And I already, when I was living in Germany, didn't like this reliance on supermarkets, and particularly not knowing where my food had come from and how it had been grown, not knowing, you know, what chemicals have been used to aid the growth of that food. So that was one of the drivers for me of wanting to grow my own food. And that actually leads me on to something else which she said, and there was a question that you asked about impatience.
Yes.
Dealing with impatience, and I loved the answer that she gave about when she planted all her crops and then the weeds took over. And I can definitely resonate with, I mean, she was trying to protect it from the deer, but then something else came, you know, the weeds took over, or you know, an insect, a bug might come and eat all of your cabbage, or you know, something like this. And this is what I can resonate with. And I think especially when you're talking about working with the land and working with animals and working with nature, you have to be flexible, and you have to expect that things might go wrong. You can't have your high expectations. We talked about this as well, about, yes, I'm going to do this and I'm going to produce that, because I'm finding it such a humbling experience working in a garden, working with the soil. Not only when things go wrong, but also when things go surprisingly right and you get wonderful produce. We got lovely strawberries this year, for example, and lovely gooseberries in our garden. And it just makes me feel so grateful simply that food has come out of the earth in my garden and I'm able to eat it. You know, it's a humbling experience, and that it's not up to you to get the food. It's up to the land to give it to you, and you can't force it, at least if you want to consume natural food and not the chemically laden pesticide or genetically modified stuff you get in supermarkets. Mm-hmm. So that was another important thing for me, how humbling it is to work with the land.
Yeah, well, that I can totally understand what you're saying, and that connected with something else that Rika said when she was talking about her time in Slovenia. And I would like to talk about that, and it's, I mean, to hear what you think also. This primary intention that we have to control things, you know, connected with goals, and we want to achieve those goals and those expectations, and then things don't go out like that. How can we be adaptive and also let go and adapt those goals so that we can move forward? Sometimes the goals change, or they're not reachable. And I think it was connected with what she said of being impatient, that she wanted this and she wanted that. But actually, even sometimes things just happen, mm-hmm. you know, and they didn't happen to you. Yeah, I have to remember that it was Andrea Houston in our first interview who said that. And also, I'm reminded by what Omolade in her pursuit of her PhD, remember she said that, okay, I didn't manage it in 2 years as I first wanted, but it was a year and a half later, and that's also okay. That, yeah, that things come in the way, and being able to adapt and to let go, I think it's crucial to achieving these big hairy goals.
Exactly. And I think, yeah, I mean, we talked about this with Rika as well, that you have to have expectations, and yeah, set your expectations high. And you asked this question about, you know, the problem with doing that is that you can be disappointed, but you've got to be able to balance those, you know, set your expectations high, but don't be disappointed if you don't reach what you were aiming for. Because maybe it wasn't meant to be that thing that you were aiming for. Maybe it was meant to be something else. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think the purpose of a goal is to give you direction, you know, to point you in the way that you want to go. But you can't possibly know at the beginning all of the exact details of how you're going to get there. And so if things come up in the way, the obstacles that come up are part of the way, and they help you to achieve your goal in the end. So, you know, everything that's happening, for example, here in my garden, and I imagine in Rika's as well, is part of the journey which we're both on to become self-sufficient, to achieve our end goal of becoming self-sufficient.
Now tell us what we're hearing in the back, Helen. What's that?
Can you hear a little chirping in the background? Yeah, so I've been incubating some eggs. And there were 6 eggs in total, and 4 have hatched. So just yesterday, they're only 1 day old. So I showed Maribel with the camera here, my little baby chicks. And that, again, it's a humbling experience, because I didn't know how many of the chicks were going to hatch. And sometimes, you know, you only get like a 50% success rate. And so I was, you know, talking to them every day and turning them and doing everything that I had to do to the eggs, not knowing what was going on in the eggs. And then yesterday, it was such a wonderful experience when the first one, you know, kind of pecked through the egg and surfaced, and then another 3 followed. And it's amazing. It's so humbling.
Beautiful. Well, they're certainly very cute.
They are.
Another topic that we discussed with Rika was where she lived with her family. And I was very curious about the tiny house that they used for 2 years, which also, in my own experience, you know, when you're planning a house, you think the bigger, the better. One room for everyone, for each person of the family. And actually, what I have realized is that smaller can be nicer because it's cozier. You don't have to worry about what kind of furniture that I have to put there, and to have rooms with multiple purposes that you can change and adapt depending on your needs, the age of your children, that kind of thing. So I was quite interested in, especially in a tiny house, how, yeah, it's also about sustainability. How can you reduce what you own to what is really absolutely necessary? That's the biggest, I would say, challenge here, because we are in a society that glorifies buying and consumerism and having more. Something is broken, then just throw it away, buy a new one. And this is exactly the opposite.
I agree. The thing that resonated with me the most about the tiny house was what she was saying about the sound of the rain on the roof.
Mm.
And this is what I experienced, because we did a lot of camping. Well, you've done camping as well, haven't you, Maribel?
Yeah.
We did a lot of camping earlier and also traveling by camper van. And that was one of the things that I miss it when I'm in a, you know, standard bricks and mortar house. Mm. I just feel that I'm so far removed from nature, whereas if you're camping or if you're staying in a camper van, you're right in it, in the nature. And I just think it's so important. So if you're living in a normal house, you need to get out every day. You know, I'm not saying hug a tree, but at least, you know, go out into green areas and breathe the fresh air, because it's just so important to be outside and to be in nature every day. It just does wonders for your mood and for your soul.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of our podcast Audaciousness. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. A huge thanks to Rika for sharing her very interesting, at least for me, story about becoming self-sufficient. Thank you so much, Rika, for sharing that with us.
If you enjoyed this episode, please give it a like. And if you think someone else would benefit from listening to this conversation, pass it on to them, share it with your friends and family and colleagues. If you know of any other audacious person, including yourself, please get in touch, as we'd like to speak with you.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with another audacious person and another audacious episode. See you soon. Bye.
Bye.